I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views. On this edition of Parallax Views, China has been at the center of the coronavirus pandemic, with the first reported cases of COVID-19 coming out of Wuhan. Now reports are rolling in of China experiencing a potential second wave of the virus after a slowdown in cases. Additionally, China's response to coronavirus has generated controversy for being draconian. Moreover, much has been made of the role that Chinese wet markets may have played in unleashing the virus. And of course, there are even some who believe the virus is all China's fault. Hence, President Trump saying sometime back that coronavirus could be called the China virus. There's even folks implying or straight out saying that this could be a Chinese bioweapon. Joining us on this edition of the program is Ian Goodrum of the China Daily to provide a different perspective on China and the coronavirus pandemic. Now, I must warn you, Ian Goodrum is explicitly pro-China. He makes no bones about it and will tell you that his views on these matters are influenced by that pro-China perspective. So I suspect that this may prove a controversial conversation for some of my listeners. But as always, Parallax Views likes to provide perspectives that will challenge its own audience. And as such, I believed it would be interesting to have a conversation with Ian, getting his take as an American in China working for a Chinese state-owned media outlet on the pandemic. Make of it what you will. Think critically as always. You may agree with some parts and disagree with other parts, but I think you'll find it a fascinating conversation. And with that being said, let's get right into the conversation with Ian Goodrum of China Daily on the coronavirus pandemic and China. Welcome to Parallax Views, Ian Goodrum of China Daily. You're in Beijing right now, and it seems like things have maybe gotten back to normal a little bit in China. We'll have to talk about that. But for my listeners, maybe you could introduce yourself and also have to ask. Hope everything is going well for you today.
Yeah, no, things are fine. I appreciate that. I hope. I mean, I honestly, at this point, I'm more worried about people that are in the U.S. So I send it right back to you and hope things are going well, because I feel like there's a lot more cause for alarm there than there is here now. I'm an editor and a columnist with China Daily. I've been in Beijing for going on 2 years. Started in late 2017, so a little while. And yeah, I mean, in terms of my personal experience, it's just been doing what I think a lot of people in the U.S. are now doing, or at least I hope they are, which is to say staying home, only really going out for absolutely necessary trips. For me, I was still going into the office because I live quite close to the office, but the office is practically empty. Most people are working from home. And so it's been basically the triangle of home, office, and the store to pick up essentials once a week or so.
I'm sorry to disappoint, but no, we have not been responding accordingly.
That's okay. That's not especially comforting to hear, but I appreciate the honesty. Yeah, and everywhere you go when you go out, you wear a mask. Not necessarily a full-on N95 or KN95 surgical mask for medical professionals, but something to cover up your nose and mouth to avoid kind of – because the virus spreads mostly through droplets, and those are spread most easily by coughing and sneezing or just heavy breathing, wearing the mask does mitigate that to a pretty decent degree where it makes sense for everybody to wear them, whether they are exhibiting symptoms or not. And so that's been my day-to-day experience for the last, I would say, about 2 months or so, has been just the, you know, there's a very small radius of space in which I've traveled for the last several weeks.
And for my listeners, maybe you could give just a brief rundown of what China Daily does. I know we're going to have some listeners that will immediately point out that China Daily is a paper of the Chinese Communist Party. But you're actually, in interviews I've heard, pretty open about that. I don't see an issue necessarily.
No. I mean, it's fine. I think if people know where I work and people know the ownership of it, it's fine. I don't have a problem with being open about it. I'm not trying to hide anything. You know, I have my biases, and that's one of the reasons why I started working here. It's not a secret. It's in my bio. Some intrepid internet detectives find it a coup to point out that I work where I work, as if it's not publicly available information for anyone who cares to look for even a second at easily accessible info. And so for me, yes, I don't make any secret of it. What you see is what you get, and I work where I work because I have the beliefs I have. You know, it's that way and not the reverse. You know, I didn't sort of cynically adopt the beliefs I have because of where I started working. These are things I've believed for quite some time, long before I ever came here, long before I ever started working at this position. But yeah, there is that kind of double standard of people at a lot of U.S.-based or Western-based media organizations, some of which are also state-owned or state-funded, and they claim this kind of vague objectivity, right? That there's no disclaimer, there's no acknowledgement of biases, there's no admission of these pertinent facts. It's just kind of like, I am telling you the unvarnished truth, therefore, you know, you can trust me. I'm not ideological in my presentation. But of course, we know that in itself is an ideological statement, right? That you're saying that you're above something that affects everybody and everything at all times is itself a part and parcel of that whole system. So that's the distinction. That's the distinction I draw. And, you know, there's no dissembling. There's no deception here. I am who I am. I work where I work. You know, believe me or don't, it's up to you.
Well, I'm curious. So what kind of material does the China Daily cover? I know it's read by a lot of diplomats that come into the country, English language diplomats. Maybe you could just tell my listeners a little bit more about the newspaper itself.
Well, I mean, it's like it's in terms of its content, in terms of its coverage, it's pretty much the same as any other national level daily newspaper. You know, it's news, opinion, cultural coverage, features, world, U.S. politics, China, like the same stuff. It is coming from a position of wanting to shine a light on, you know, what we people that live here and Chinese people see as what China actually is, and not necessarily what it's presented as in the kind of dominant strains of the Western press. So that, I mean, but in terms of the actual, like, the actual day-to-day process of production of stories and editorials and whatnot, it's not any significant difference from my experience back in the U.S. at newspapers that I worked. Reporters report, they send in stories, those stories get edited, they then get published. It's a pretty simple process.
Yeah, I've been told that's when I've talked to people that work in the Cuban news media, they always say to me, you know, what we report on is not that much different. And it doesn't surprise me to hear that a lot of times. I think there's a perception that there's always something dark and sinister going on in foreign media. And I'm not really convinced on that the way a lot of other people are in this country. The U.S.
That's good. Yeah. I mean, it's true. There's no shadowy center by which some figure tells me what to say or what to write. It is as simple a process as any other. It's actually a little bit, the only difference in terms of the editorial control now compared to past positions at newspapers in the U.S. is in those papers in the United States, I was my own editor for the most part. So I wrote feature stories and kind of daily general interest column for the feature section, but I was also editor of the feature section. And then I wrote opinion columns in another paper, but I was also editor of the opinion page. So, there has been a degree of greater editorial control, but that is just because there is another, I'm not my own editor anymore. It's no different from someone sending in a contribution to me and I would edit it and then publish it in that form. And the thing about that is also, I can tell you that of the dozens of columns that I've written over the past couple of years, I think almost all of them have been word for word what I wrote, and the only changes that were made were discussed with me beforehand, and there were reasons. For example, there was a column I wrote about Trump backing out of the Singapore summit with the DPRK when that was fresh on the news, and I was kind of really going after him for that. This is the only time this has happened where they said, let's wait on publishing this because we don't know whether this will change. We don't know if the news will change, and we don't want to be, we don't want to put something out that's behind the news. And then lo and behold, the summit was scheduled. And so if that had been published, it would have looked, this was a day after the back out, the withdrawal was announced, but then a couple days later they went back in. So it would have been, it would have been a little silly. I found that to be a perfectly valid reason, and it was entirely justified in the end. So for me, basically everything I submit is published as I wrote it. So the idea of me being muzzled or having to self-censor is not at all true. In fact, I had to self-censor more writing in the U.S. for a number of reasons, because you can't take open communist positions and call them that in a U.S. newspaper. You won't get published. You probably won't have a job soon after. It is probably coincidence. I will emphasize this fact that it is most likely coincidence, but and my last job in the United States was at a paper in Iowa, and so I was there during the 2016 caucuses, and I met with some candidates. I interviewed Hillary Clinton at one point for our editorial board, but by October we also sat down. I organized a meeting between the editorial board and the candidate for the Party for Socialism and Liberation. I'm not a member of that party, but I am sympathetic to their stances, and I like what they do a lot. And so I wanted to give Gloria LaRiva, who was running at the time and is running again this year, a fair hearing. And following that, the next week, I wrote a column about how I will be voting for her in the general election. This was in October of 2016. And that was the last column I wrote for that paper, because the following Monday I was laid off. Now, this was part of a big layoff in Gannett. Lots of people lost their jobs at lots of papers, so it wasn't a unique situation. And it made, thinking about who was still left at that paper, it made sense, in terms of whose job could be lost, mine made the most sense. But the timing certainly set off some alarm bells for me. so my overall point being that I was subject to a lot more constraints writing in the U.S. than I ever have been writing for a newspaper here in China.
Now, of course, you're in Beijing. Maybe you could take us through a little bit. What was the experience of being a reporter sort of in the thick of this crisis when it first hit in China? Because even areas that are not necessarily being affected directly by the virus itself, maybe like Shanghai, they're still being affected in other ways, economically and whatnot.
Right. Well, I mean, I wasn't doing a lot of, I'm an editor first and an editor and columnist. So, I mean, a lot of my work, practically all my work is still done, you know, just in our office. But I mean, in terms of what I experienced just out and about, I mean, you hear some things about some people that have lost their jobs or have had to retrain for something. Like you hear about people that were in service jobs that involved direct human contact moving into like logistics or, you know, because delivery services expanded quite a bit in the context of the lockdown. So they need more people to facilitate that. So people move into those jobs and then get, you know, paid higher wages because of the crisis. But yeah, I mean, the economic impact was severe, but it was also planned for, right? I mean, this is the difference between the Chinese system, the socialist system, and a capitalist system, is that, you know, if there is an economic shock of some kind, I feel like there are enough, I mean, there is enough of a difference in the state and the economy that a socialist economy can prep for that and, you know, integrate that expected shock, that expected crisis into its larger machinery and come out the other side without experiencing this kind of large scale depression or recession or a dismal period. So the economy has definitely contracted compared to previous quarters and previous periods of time, but you're not seeing the kind of widespread layoffs that you're seeing now, because they've been deliberately minimized by the government, either injecting, you know, doing what central banks do, which is inject liquidity into an economy, or basically telling if there are a big thing was redirecting the state-owned industries into production that was necessary for dealing with the crisis. So you have companies that might not normally be working at the same pace that they were before the crisis, because there's not, you know, demand has dropped. So like car manufacturers, for example, being a big and obvious one, they've shifted their entire production lines to make masks, protective equipment, ventilators, breathing machines, all these things that we know we need because of the nature of the virus and the nature of the outbreak. So if parts of the economy shut down, they can either be restarted and redirected to make things that are more necessary to deal with the needs of the people right now, or those losses can be absorbed and the people that take it on the chin are the owners rather than the workers. So there's been lots of incentives for if there's private enterprises, for example, for the owners to continue to pay salaries for people that were normally, or if they weren't working from home, were just not working at all at the moment. So there was a big push to avoid the kind of things we're seeing right now in the United States, and that is through the direct influence of the state's control of the economy and the Communist Party's control of the economy. So all the things people say make socialist economies weaker, because they can't, you know, they're not as adaptable, they're not as innovative, they don't respond quickly to market demands because blah blah blah. You know, planned economies can't respond in inefficient ways. Well, I mean, that was already bogus, but even putting that aside, we're seeing right now the proof that that is not at all the case. That, you know, a company that employs seven times the employees that are technically necessary to do the work. The big comparison that's made in a lot of financial journals about this is like Sinopec, China's biggest energy company, biggest oil company, compared to like ExxonMobil, whereas Sinopec has roughly the same amount of revenues, the same amount of operating costs and expenses. It's roughly the same size of company as ExxonMobil, but it employs over seven times the number of people. That's not unnecessary employment. I think that term is also bogus, but it does also show us that, okay, maybe these companies have other priorities besides maximum efficiency, and maybe your criticizing of them is based on this assumption that that enterprises and firms should be working towards maximum efficiency and not other things that can't be measured in a growth chart. So in terms of what I personally have seen, it has been fairly limited because of obviously the fact that I'm not going out to meet strangers, right?
I just want to note, Wuhan is like a 2-hour, like 10-minute flight from Wuhan to Beijing. I mean, I think a lot of Americans think of China as being much smaller than it really is. It's a huge country. Yeah. So I think certain areas have been affected less by the virus than others. You can correct me if I'm wrong on that, though.
No, it's true. I mean, Beijing has been mercifully less hard hit than Hubei province and Wuhan and Zhejiang province and places farther in the south central coast and the central part of China, which is where Wuhan is, and that's obviously the hardest hit place.
What's the reason for that, out of curiosity?
The reason for the difference in impact, you mean?
Yeah, because, I mean, in the U.S. right now, it's sort of just spreading everywhere very, very mm-hmm. quickly. Why do you think there's that sort of difference in China?
Well, I mean, this is getting into the direct response, not just the kind of economic redirections that we were talking about before, but the directed response to, with the explicit intention of curbing the spread of the virus and containing it as much as possible. And, I mean, I think that's why, right? Beijing, it's the number has gone up a little bit because there's been quite a few imported cases, people that have come back into China from elsewhere that were carrying it and didn't realize because they didn't exhibit any symptoms. But at its peak, I don't think there were more than 500 cases, confirmed cases in Beijing. And that was true of a lot of other places. They had cases in the hundreds or at most the low thousands. And then of course there's tens of thousands in Hubei, which is the epicenter of the outbreak. But the reason for this is because of the rapid response, right? That after the key moment was when the China CDC confirmed without a shadow of a doubt that there was human to human transmission of the virus, which is different from limited human to human transmission. Regular community spread or human-to-human transmission is just interactions can spread the virus, whereas limited means that it's limited to close contact clusters, so families, maybe some workplaces, things like that, where previous to late January, the cases that were coming in were all pretty much close clusters, and there wasn't yet conclusive evidence of human-to-human spread. But when that was confirmed on the 20th of January, 21st of January by China time. Only a couple days later, the response was rapid and severe, right? There was a shutdown of travel in and out of Wuhan and then Hubei province, and then that slowly started to spread to other places just to make sure that you couldn't, you know, that there weren't exceptions, that you weren't going to get people that ended up traveling outside these areas and spreading the virus unknowingly. You had community-based lockdowns, so you had residential neighborhoods that you either could only go out. You could either in the worst places like Wuhan, you either couldn't go out and supplies would be delivered to you by volunteers and government officials. Or in some places you would have a lockdown where you couldn't leave the house except every 3 days you could go out for essential supplies, but then come right back. Like that was the limit of your trip, your potential trips to the outside. And then other places like Beijing, for example, there was not an official lockdown in terms of like you can't leave, but businesses shut down, large gatherings were banned. Functionally, it was pretty similar where everybody just kind of followed the same guidelines and they didn't go out except for when it was absolutely necessary. They didn't have to, but they were kind of abiding by common sense and what good caution would tell them. And so with that kind of approach, that was how you started to contain movement. The other thing that made the biggest difference, according to the World Health Organization, is a robust tracking and testing regime where temperatures were being taken at the entry and exit of practically everywhere. So residential communities, shopping malls, supermarkets, any public area practically that wasn't closed. And so because the most common symptom of COVID-19 is a fever, 90% of patients present a fever with their case, it was a good barometer for who had the virus and who didn't. So if you showed a fever, you were then kind of shuffled off. You were pointed in the direction of your closest fever clinic, which is where you would have to go. And there you would be given a test via a, I believe a CT scan was the first line of testing. So a CT scan will show you your lungs, your image of your lungs, and it will show whether you have these kinds of ground glass opacities that mean that's a symptom of the virus. And then if you showed that, then you would get an actual COVID-19 nucleic acid test that would determine whether you have the virus or don't. If you were determined not to have it, then you were set out. If they determine you did have it, depending on the severity of your symptoms. I mean, the people that were exhibiting really, really rough symptoms were already in the hospital. But the problem is you have people still walking around passing on the virus by either showing mild symptoms or no symptoms at all. And so by making this a mandatory process people had to go through if they demonstrated a fever, you got everybody who was confirmed to have the virus. You also, because you've been tracking movement, because if you go, you know, most places you have to mark down your name and your phone number. I had to do this last weekend because I went out of the triangle for the first time to get a haircut. And they took my temperature, my name, and my phone number at the hair salon. They took my name and my temperature at the place I went for lunch. So there is tracking, movement tracking, to show that, okay, if you have the virus – if you're confirmed, they have a record of where you were, they have a record of what you were doing, and they have a record of anybody else who also was there around the same time. And so those people are also put under observation. So this took a little bit of time to develop this multi-tiered system. And in the meantime, you know, the whole country had to work on developing better tests, building new hospital facilities to contain people that were showing the worst symptoms in Wuhan and Hubei. Building up infrastructure, moving medical workers into the hardest areas where they're most needed. So we had about 42,000 medical workers going into Wuhan and Hubei, none of whom were infected because of the effectiveness of protection and prevention and treatment that was going on. This took time to build up, but now there is a workable system for fighting the virus on a massive scale that was built and perfected in China, and other countries are slowly but surely picking up on this. The countries that are faster to take action, like the Republic of Korea being one example, Singapore being another example, have had very few cases. And the cases that they have had have mostly recovered because with proper treatment, it is, for some severe cases, anguish and painful and terrible, but they do recover. And then, of course, for the milder cases, then you recover with bed rest and isolation. And the other thing I'll say, just because I've been going on for a while, but there is a lot to cover when it comes to China's response, is that the people with mild symptoms, the people with mild symptoms or no symptoms that test positive for the virus in Wuhan, Hubei, other places, have also been centralized and quarantined. So even if you're not showing symptoms, you get put into these repurposed facilities made from football stadiums or sports arenas, university campuses. Big institutions have repurposed their facilities for the purpose of centralized quarantine of mild patients and confirmed patients so that they can't infect anybody else. Because even if you do home quarantine, even if you say, okay, you can't leave the house for 2 weeks, well, unless you live by yourself, then the chances are good you will infect your friends and family or people that you live with, and they could become severe. They could have to go to hospital. They could also, after your two weeks of quarantine are over, they might not do the 2 weeks of quarantine right after they were infected because they might not show symptoms yet. So by putting everybody in these centralized locations, keeping them away from the general population, and by treating the people that need the most care, giving everybody the proper level of treatment and having a system that filters them into those levels, the appropriate levels, you had a virus wave that was ebbing by mid-February in Wuhan and Hubei, and outside of Wuhan and Hubei and other parts of China, was dropping. You had far fewer cases. You had a decline, a flattening of the curve, so to speak, and a downturn of the curve as well. And so, yes, we had two months and change of some pretty, and people in major cities did not have a problem staying home. The big issue is people out in rural areas who don't have the kind of technological access that they do have some, but it's not as robust and it's not as solid as in major cities yet, because China is still a developing country. But even still, you suffer through the month and a half or 2 months of quarantine, basic quarantine, de facto quarantine. And you now have a situation where the new cases each day are numbering in the dozens instead of the hundreds and thousands, like they are in other parts of the world right now.
I was gonna ask about that. I've heard some people claim that China is claiming that it has eradicated all cases of coronavirus. I haven't actually seen that from any Chinese sources. My understanding is that it's been slowed down. The impact of this virus.
Yeah, I mean, the official statement that came out whenever Xi Jinping, the president of China, went to Wuhan was that the fight had been basically won. But that's, basically is a big qualifier. It's not like there's going to be no more cases ever. There are still, yeah. I mean, and those are being publicly reported. Again, people complain about transparency, but I think those are totally false. Those complaints are totally false. It's slowed down to a degree that it is now fairly safe to out as long as you are careful and cautious. I'm still being extra careful and extra cautious, but that's just me. You know, when I go out, I see people out living their lives as normal again. People are back out in the parks and out in the streets. But no, there's been no claim that there's no new cases. There's been no claim that it's totally over. In fact, the biggest risk now, because of people coming back into China, because there's a lot of Chinese nationals who were abroad, either as students or living in other countries, who are now coming back to China because they don't feel safe in those countries anymore. And some of them are infected. And so the majority of cases now are imported from elsewhere. And so there are still measures being taken to avoid a second wave, a new outbreak. People are happy to be able to go out in the streets again, but they're not complacent. They're not like, well, they're not licking doorknobs. It's still being taken very seriously, to the point where, because Beijing is such a high traffic part of the country, and the airport, at least before the crisis, was the highest in terms of volume, of passenger volume in the world, flights into Beijing for a time were being redirected into 12 other cities for testing and medical observation, because they want to make sure that people traveling in from internationally aren't carrying the virus. And for a lot of the people that are flying back into Beijing that have been redirected to other places, a lot of them are not passing the tests, and they have to sit in 2-week quarantine in whatever city they land. Oh, that's not an ideal situation, and it's, I'm sure it sucks and is bad for the people that have to do that. But at the same time, if that's what it takes to stop the spread of this very infectious, very serious virus, then I'm not going to fault the Chinese government for doing that. And now, just to make doubly sure that there won't be this issue, the entry into China has been temporarily restricted to everybody, even people with visas and residence permits, except for special cases, like obviously the transport of medical material. You have to be able to enter the country for that. So there's no indication this isn't being taken seriously. There's no indication that people are getting, like I said, complacent and feeling like they can do whatever they want. People are still staying home. Like I'm not that unusual in that I'm also staying home. Lots of people are doing that, and it's just makes sense.
Casey, do you want to add anything to the conversation so far? You've been a little bit quiet.
Yeah. So I'd be remiss to deny that hate crimes against Asian Americans have been on the rise since this crisis began, and I was wondering if the treatment you or any of your any expat colleagues you might know, if your treatment in China has markedly changed in the years that you've been there since this crisis began. Is there any do you, I guess there are two questions, but I'll save the second one for later.
Okay. Excuse me. Yeah, I understand the question. There's been some scattered reports of foreigners being treated poorly. I have not experienced any of that myself. But at the same time, I have, as I said, been keeping to the triangle. But no, this is not something I've experienced at all. Not before this started, and not during, and not, I guess we could tentatively say, after. No, I have not encountered any of that sort of treatment. But I'm sure it's possible that some isolated incidents are occurring. Certainly, I wouldn't deny that. But personally, no, that has not been something I've encountered.
Okay, and I guess my second question then would have been, I guess maybe less of a question, more of a statement. But a lot of American press has reported, even when favorable to the People's Republic of China's response to the crisis, they've categorized it as what's the word for? As very broad based, as very onerous, as being too extreme, I guess, is the undertone. And would you describe that as a? It's usually that kind of comparison is made with regards to South Korea, which is generally considered to have been, among Western press, the country that best responded to it. So I guess I'd like you to expand a little more on the differences between how China and South Korea responded, and more accurately, why China was not owner, why the Communist Party of China and the state of the People's Republic, all of it was proportional to the scale of the crisis.
Yeah, I mean, it's odd to talk about comparisons, because a lot of what ROK is doing is what China is and is doing and did. You know, they have a widespread testing regime. They have built facilities, or they've repurposed facilities to house confirmed patients. They are expanding hospital capacity. They are sending in healthcare workers. Like, a lot of what they're doing is what China was doing. And it has been successful because those tactics work. It doesn't matter what kind of governance system or economic system you have in that, if you use these methods to respond in a rapid and sincere fashion, then the number of cases will drop. The difference, I would argue, is that there's a lot more political will and capability behind doing these measures in a country with a socialist economy and governed by a communist party. But that's, and I think that's borne out in the response by Vietnam as well, because Vietnam took very similar measures, and their total cases have only numbered in the hundreds so far. But people are certainly trying to cast blame. The things you refer to, the authoritarian, quote unquote, the draconian, quote unquote, measures that were being taken by China, this is the stuff that people were saying in late January and early February, as the Wuhan lockdown, as the travel restrictions were put in place, as these community-based restrictions were put in place. This was their attempt to kind of criticize China for its response. Now, as the case numbers started to drop, it became clear that the so-called draconian measures were working and were in fact effective at containing the spread. And in the absence of those methods, we are now seeing far worse results in other countries. There was a brief period, very brief indeed, in early March, where the press had to admit to the success of the Chinese response, because the WHO sent a team in and they had positive things to say. And so the press had to report those positive things. And now what we're seeing is a kind of retrospective restructuring of their entire argument, where they're now saying, well, China should have done more sooner. They didn't think the response was robust enough in the early days, and they think that it should have been more. Well, you can go back a month or two, or even a few weeks, and see them talking about the restriction of of human rights and civil liberties and all the terrible, horrible things that were being done. So they changed their tune pretty much based on what angle they think can best attack China. It's not based on any actual reality. It's based on what line of attack is best for discrediting China in the eyes of the American people, people in the West, and especially the American people, as their country's response has been abysmal. So now you're hearing things about China faking its infection numbers, faking its death counts based on absolutely spurious quote-unquote evidence that has no basis in fact or reality. They have to keep changing their tactics because they're losing, you know, what they see as a kind of information war. China just wanted to contain the virus. China wants to now help others because it now has surplus materials and surplus expertise and personnel that it can send to other places to help them contain their own outbreaks, because they don't see it as a kind of, you know, they're not basing this on any country. They're sending help to fellow socialist countries, capitalist countries, and the United States. So there's not an ideological component to its aid. And in response to this, the press has to find some new angle of attack. And so before it was, just a little while ago, was, well, they didn't do enough. Or they claim a cover-up, but they provide no evidence to support this claim. And then before that, it was, well, this is too much. It's authoritarian. There's like one video of one apartment building where somebody got shut in by the authorities or by the community leaders. So they put like a metal bar over the door so they could still get supplies in, but they couldn't go out. And that video gets passed around, and it said, well, this is what's happening everywhere, but there's no evidence of that. I think that it's very cynical, deliberate, opportunistic kind of shifting around of the narrative, because when the facts start countering the narrative they set up before, they have to set up a new one. And so the new one they have now is they didn't do enough and they're lying.
In regards to the numbers and the tallies, I've been very apprehensive when it comes to this idea that not only China, but there is press now in the US claiming that everyone's lying. Italy is deliberately lying, apparently. And my view is much more that, and maybe you'll disagree with this, I don't think any one country can necessarily have like completely accurate totals, because there's so many asymptomatic cases that are being unreported. I don't know what you think of that, though.
No, I mean, I agree. That's the thing, right? Do I think that the numbers being put out by China represent every single case of the virus that ever existed within the borders of the PRC? No, I do not. Of course not. Because there's, as you say, there's no way to do that. I mean, Wuhan came very close, because at a certain point they brought in everybody who was under observation, everybody who might have had contact. They basically went door to door checking people's temperatures and then doing the tests. And so for one day they actually had a huge uptick of about 14,000 cases because of this new metric they were using, where they were going to count people that showed symptoms that hadn't tested positive yet as cases, so that then those people could be marshaled through the process of treatment without regard for whether they've tested positive on a nucleic acid test. So if anything, the Wuhan numbers are more accurate than the numbers for the rest of China. But at the same time, I don't think you can dismiss the numbers coming out of China as being falsified or phony, because there's no, number one, there's no proof of this. But then also, I mean, yeah, again, I don't think that it's perfectly representative of every single case, but I do think that you do get a good metric of an approximation of how many cases and the trend lines of the cases that exist, because you can look at the curve and see what's being done. I think this is true for every other country as well. I think that's true for, you know, I don't even think the U.S. is uniquely falsifying information. I think there was a problem with testing that led to a backlog of potential cases, and I think that's a problem. But I also understand the explanation is there wasn't any testing, and that is a failure of the U.S. government and the U.S. response. But it doesn't mean that there was a cover up or a deliberate attempt to falsify records. It's just another kind of misstep, which, you know, we can call it a misstep or we can call it deliberate. I don't know, could be either, but it was obviously a failure either way. But yeah, I think that every country has a motive, has the same motive to downplay the severity of the outbreak. And every country probably, intentionally or not, has undercounted their numbers because it's just hard to know. It's hard to know who has it and who doesn't if people don't come in for testing. So yeah, I don't think China is unique, but I do think that the lens by which China is being analyzed for its results and its numbers is unique. And there is a unique amount of scrutiny being placed and a unique amount of suspicion and skepticism being placed on China because of the same institutional biases and the same kind of the same kind of informational warfare campaign that's been waged on the country for decades. There is a unique skepticism being placed because there is just an ingrained skepticism of everything that comes out of the country because they cannot believe for a second that containment has worked. They cannot believe for a second that China has done a better job than, say, the United States. So they must be lying. That's the only possible conclusion, and there's just no factual basis for it. So the tendency for underreporting, I think, is present everywhere, and the motivations are the same everywhere, but it's only a country like China and, to a lesser extent, Iran that will get these kinds of wild accusations thrown their way because there is an informational infrastructure, a state apparatus in place to amplify those accusations. And that has worked to amplify suspicion and doubt among the people for a long time, to the point where if you throw a couple of those accusations out there, people will just kind of accept it as fact without even asking for a second where the proof is.
It's interesting you mentioned the information war aspect. I wanted to get into that at least briefly because we already have sort of elements of the fringe in the United States saying, oh, this could have been some type of bio warfare, or it could have been escaped from a lab.
You say sitting U.S. senators. So
fair enough. Well, I guess it was going to lead into my question of there has been talk of in the Western press here of elements of the Chinese media saying that the opposite is being said in China, that this was a U.S. bioweapon. Maybe you can clarify on that. What is the truth or falsity of that sort of claim being made right now in the U.S.?
The only official position that's been taken by the Chinese government on the virus's origin is that it's still being found out by scientific investigation and epidemiology, virological studies. And that we're all waiting for that. We're waiting for the science to bear out what the actual origin is, and that it doesn't really matter what the origin is because the virus is spreading everywhere because the virus doesn't care where you're from or what country it's in, which I think are perfectly fair points. The claim that there's an official Chinese position that the virus came from the U.S. comes from one specific foreign ministry spokesman who has posted a couple things about that on Twitter, and they've taken that to represent the entirety of the Chinese state and the Communist Party, which is what they do. As one individual case gets extrapolated to the entire country, because apparently the country is a monolith and doesn't have a diversity of opinion, the same goes for one government official who happens to have a pretty large following on Twitter saying these things, basically, and I think it's pretty clear also he was saying these in response to the accusations from U.S. government officials that it was a Chinese lab-developed, lab-grown virus. Senator Tom Cotton has led the charge on that, but now Ted Cruz is in on it. Marco Rubio has been leaning that way for a little while, and you've got major media figures in the Washington Post and elsewhere making this claim now.
Well, I mean, we have Donald Trump calling this the China virus. So,
right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. I mean, whether this one spokesman actually believes that it came from the U.S. is kind of irrelevant. I think it was more about, you know, if your top government officials are going to start throwing these accusations around, we're going to respond. And that was kind of on his own initiative, and it doesn't necessarily represent the whole of the Chinese government. And in fact, a foreign ministry spokesman clarified the official position just a few days later, saying that it was about what science can discover for us, what we can determine about it, and that as we continue to wait for confirmation, and it may take a long time, you know, the patient zero for patient zero for a massive pandemic outbreak, it takes a long time to discover the origin. And even in some, we still don't know. We still don't know, for example, what happened in the 1918-1919 flu outbreak. Part of that is because medical technology was a little bit less advanced at the time. But even more recent outbreaks, we don't exactly know. So the idea of painting this as a Chinese virus or an American virus, I don't really put much stock in. And I also don't think that the government of China has an official position blaming the U.S. military for it. That was just played up in the U.S. because, again, this is part of the campaign. You know, you want to demonize your opponent as much as possible, and you want to attribute things to them that they might not actually believe or say. And that worked for some people. It got their dander up. But I think the priority right now is just fighting this thing. It doesn't matter where it's spreading. It needs to be stopped. So, I mean, that is the closest thing to an official position there actually is.
No, I just wanted to clarify that, because I've just been pretty fed up with all the conspiracy theories in general. The idea that it's a bioweapon to me just seems bizarre, because whoever created it, if it was a bioweapon, it's going to be killing their people too. So I think people should probably back off on that just completely. It's just ridiculous to me that people are speculating without, you know, having the scientific facts out there.
Right. Well, I mean, and the people that are pushing this theory aren't epidemiologists or virologists or any kind of experts on it. You know, the experts say that there's no evidence of it being grown in a lab. All the tracing, all the sequencing, all the genetic data tells them that it is, you know, it's a zoonotic disease that came from animals, jumped from animal to animal, then to humans. And there's no evidence for even a lab accident, right? Which is starting to get a little bit more play, because it's the more plausible alternative to the bioweapon conspiracy theory. Instead, it's now the lab accident conspiracy theory. So the narrative is shifting there too, even among the fringe, because that is now getting play. There was just a column in the Washington Post that posited this. So it's getting some play in mainstream outlets now too. But there's no evidence for either.
Also, before we start wrapping up, I wanted to ask, I mean, I'm seeing articles now going after the World Health Organization, calling them an accomplice to China. I've been saying I think what the WHO is telling people to do, especially the five steps, is pretty important. So I'm not as clear on why people are saying this about the World Health Organization, but I'm curious as to what you make of this talk of the World Health Organization and its relationship to China. I don't completely understand all the criticism coming out. All of this is happening so fast.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, it's fine to be skeptical of any kind of international organization propped up by capitalist powers. But as far as those go, the WHO has been pretty decent about how it has followed this virus, and how it is treated, how it has shared information about the various responses from various countries. I mean, the claim has no basis. In fact, again, the basis for it is just that they spoke positively about China's response, and that they aren't calling it the Wuhan virus or the China virus or whatever, because of, I mean, this is patently false as well, that they're doing it because of Chinese influence. Well, no, the WHO changed its best practices for virus naming several years ago, and they explicitly said they don't want to have names that tie the virus to a geographic area or a people or an animal or anything that would give it a kind of stigma. This happened in 2015. Well, this is the first big pandemic we've gotten since 2015, so this is the first use of those naming conventions. That's not proof of Chinese influence. It's proof of them adopting a good policy and then using it. Just because we used to call things like, you know, the 1918-1919 flu used to be called the Spanish flu, even though it didn't actually originate in Spain. You know, that's bad. We don't want to tie viruses to nations or countries or peoples, because that's not how they work. They don't care. Again, they don't care about where they are or where they came from. They care about who they can infect next.
Well, no one ever refers to mad cow disease as British disease.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the H1N1 the H1N1 flu outbreak started in North America, in Mexico and the United States, but nobody's calling that, you know, the Mexico virus or the U.S. virus. And then the other, I mean, and the other thing that doesn't make any sense as far as the WHO being in China's pocket, the government that gives the most money to the WHO is the United States. Like, the U.S. is the biggest funder of the WHO out of all world governments. So if anything, if you want to argue that they have a motivation to be biased, they have a motivation to be biased in favor of the U.S. But they're, you know, they've done a pretty good job of keeping out of that kind of nonsense. And the accusations that it's a bought and paid for organization by China just have no evidence. The claims people make about China falsifying data, lying, covering up, buying off the WHO, show me any proof of this. Show me any information besides your vague suppositions and your vague reckonings, your vague distrust of China that's based on, again, an informational campaign that's gone on for decades to try to prove to you that the Chinese aren't worth trusting. Well, guess what? It worked, because now you can just say whatever you want and people will believe it.
When I'm curious too, when did China notify the WHO of the sort of first inklings that this was happening, the outbreak? Because I believe it was the end of December.
It was the last day of December. It was New Year's Eve, yeah, December 31st. And I mean, this is the thing too about the early response. I think that there's some culpability for local officials who no longer have a job, where they could have done a little bit more without causing too much alarm. But the actual timeline doesn't line up with the notion that China was trying to cover things up, because some people will say the first case was in November, which is true, but okay, so that's one case that's been tracked back to November, meaning that one person went to a hospital in Wuhan with presenting pneumonia-like symptoms, got treated, and left. So if a hospital sees that, they're just going to assume that it was a pneumonia, right? Because people do develop that for all kinds of reasons, not necessarily because of a brand new virus. It wasn't until mid-December, early to mid-December, where patients started to go into hospitals with these symptoms, and it wasn't until mid to late December that hospitals started noticing the symptoms were the same. It wasn't until December 16th that a cluster of patients went in from the same family exhibiting the same symptoms that would indicate that there was a common cause of these symptoms, possibly a virus. And it wasn't until December 26th and 27th, 25th, 26th, depending on whether you're using China time or Western time, that a doctor at a Hubei hospital started seeing the same symptoms in CT scans and passed those on to the hospital, who then passed them on to the regional CDCs. So this idea that there being one case was obvious evidence enough for the response to start being immediate, well, that's total nonsense. You know, if somebody is exhibiting flu symptoms, right, the assumption, even though the flu-like symptoms can be caused by all manner of things, what is the first thing a doctor is going to think? The flu. They're not going to think a brand new virus coming out of nowhere. So it took a few weeks after the first groups of patients were coming in, but that is in keeping with what we know about how viruses work and how epidemiological study works and how we pick up on these things. You know, it's not a, you know, first case, immediately everybody's on it. It is a, we have to see multiple people exhibiting the same or similar symptoms from similar geographic areas, or in the case of some, same households. So yeah, the WHO was informed on the 31st. They were told that it was probably a new coronavirus based on what the medical experts who'd already been sent into Wuhan and Hubei, because the response was already happening. That's what they were being told. That's what they were telling the CDC, and that's what the CDC was telling the WHO. The US CDC got told on possibly as early as New Year's Day, but definitely as late as January 3rd. The head of the CDC was informed by his Chinese counterpart, and his Chinese counterpart, according to the New York Times, actually, this is one thing where I'm surprised they included it, but I think at the time the narrative was different. The Chinese CDC head was in tears telling him about how serious this was going to be, and still action was not taken. So this notion of a cover-up, it does not make any sense at all, you know, and this idea of falsifying the severity of the crisis, downplaying it. Well, it's hard to downplay something when you are doing an unprecedented lockdown on the most number of people in the history of the human race. I think at that point you might want to take it seriously, but people are going to fabricate whatever they want.
I was going to say, I've told people, I think it would be hard. I mean, there's talk of Russia massively falsifying numbers too. And I've said to people, I think it's very hard for any country to cover up massively catastrophic numbers of deaths. I think that's just very difficult to do. And that's why I'm very skeptical of this sort of conspiratorial narratives arising right now.
Right. I mean, the proof that's being used right now, there's two things that are being used as proof right now. This idea that there has been a massive increase in the number of urns that have been transported into Wuhan and Hubei, to the point where they're estimating 40,000 to 46,000 deaths based on, and this is ridiculous that the Washington Post just reported this today or yesterday, but based on social media posts, so just random people on Chinese social media, it's like a random person on Twitter posts back of the napkin math essentially. That says, well, if the incinerators in these crematoriums were running 24 hours a day, they would have this. They would have produced this. They would have cremated this many people. That's the estimate. That's the evidence that they're using. I use evidence very loosely with huge quotes because it's not evidence at all. But this is the claim. You know, some random people on social media have said, well, it must be this number because we're assuming that this then this happened, as if. Number one, as if people only died from this virus over the course of the last 3 months. I'm pretty sure people still keep dying of other causes, even during a pandemic. And in fact, people with other issues like cancer or heart disease are going to die in greater numbers because the hospital system is stressed to a greater degree. But yeah, just these total bogus estimates that make absolutely no sense and have no scientific rigor to them whatsoever are being reported as fact in the Washington Post. Bloomberg, Times, CNN all aired this out as if it was credible or worth reporting, and now people are believing it. The other thing is that apparently there's been a calculation that 21 million cell phone users have cell phone accounts have been closed. Now, this is a very obviously like very specious kind of idea, but think about for 1 second, okay. In a situation, in an epidemic situation where people are staying at home, right? In a situation where you're not going out too much, is it that implausible? Is it that too ridiculous to believe that some people might have that in a country of 1.5 billion people, that a few million might have canceled their accounts because they don't need it because they have Wi-Fi? Is it that implausible to believe that people that had a work phone and a home phone, migrant workers especially who travel from their home provinces maybe to a larger city, and because those cities are in a different province or are a province all their own, have different cell phone networks and so they need a different SIM card. Those people might have canceled their work accounts because they don't need them for however long the outbreak lasts. Is it ridiculous to think that people who travel a lot between provinces have more than one SIM card because, again, you get a cheaper rate if you're within the province of your SIM card? They might just switch out their SIM cards to pay less for their wireless bill. Do you think those people might have canceled their accounts? There are a ton of reasons why this might have happened that have absolutely nothing to do with a secret mass death campaign, like a secret mass death cover-up. But again, people believe what they want to believe. And because for 70 years, going on longer, there has been a concerted effort to paint China under the Communist Party, the PRC, in a certain light, that campaign has been very successful. And so you can basically say whatever you want, people will believe it.
I just wanted to, if I could, I wanted to editorialize a bit. I try not to editorialize during these interviews, but my sort of basic view on things with coronavirus right now is, with whatever is happening in China, I'm in the U.S., and right now all I'm seeing is that we don't have enough hospital beds, we don't have enough ventilators, and the hospitals are going to be overwhelmed. So I'm much more concerned about that situation domestically for at least a U.S. perspective of things than I am about China. And I kind of find all the talk about China in lieu of what is actually happening right now in the U.S. to be mixing up priorities. The other thing I would editorialize, and I would say this, is my big concern with this sort of information war taking place now when it comes to great power politics, U.S. versus China. It's U.S. versus China. I think this crisis requires a sort of global coordinated cooperative effort. I don't know if China is open to that. I don't think the U.S. is open to it, judging by our response. But I think ultimately, and this will upset a lot of listeners that I have, I think the U.S. has to work with China. I think we have to work together. Different countries globally need to fight this thing. That's my view.
Yeah,
I would push back against the notion that China is not at least orienting around a somewhat internationalist position with regards to how to deal with this crisis, but
I didn't say that. I'm saying I don't think the U.S. Wants to work with China right now. I can't speak for China.
I certainly think that China is oriented in that direction. I mean, they're begging basically for the U.S. to lift sanctions against Venezuela, Iran, Cuba, countries that are getting hit really hard by this because sanctions, you know, for all the claims that they say, well, we don't keep humanitarian aid out. Well, okay, but you have sanctions on the officials that control the imports of medicine and the imports of necessary goods. So yes, you do. I mean, calling for sanctions to be lifted, sending masks and medical supplies to countries who need it, sending experts in, coordinating information, sharing the experience of China in fighting the virus. I mean, these are all things that China is doing right now. And there is a concerted attempt to also throw water on this as if it's a sort of influence play. Also, it's like, there's nothing that China can do. There's nothing that a country that the U.S. has targeted can do that won't get painted in this way, that won't get painted with a cynical kind of – with an accusation that has no basis in reality, or whether it's true or not. I mean, look, I am sure that there is some amount of influence that China hopes to get with these measures, of course. But, I think that takes a back seat to the reality, which is people are dying and they need help and they don't think they really care where it's coming from.
Well, it's funny you say that because I was going to mention that I'm having a guest from Serbia on tomorrow, and I said to them sometime back, it feels like forever now, but it was probably only a week or so ago. I said, you know, if I were Serbian, I'd probably accept China's help. Because it doesn't seem like the EU is doing you guys much good. And or not that's China trying to influence things, I mean, at the end of the day, if you're Serbian, you kind of want to live right now. You don't want to die.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, is a Serbian doctor or a Spanish doctor, a Dutch, UK, French, whatever, are they gonna take a look at where their PPE came from and say, I'm not putting that on? because it's got a Chinese flag on it or because it came from China. No, they're putting it on because they need it to live. These are the important things right now. And I do believe that, you know, you can't necessarily discount the every motive, but I think China wants to help. I think China doesn't want the world to look like Wuhan used to look. People just can't take it for what it is. People have to look upon it with some kind of skepticism or doubt when, I mean, you know, a mask is a mask, man. Like, take it. Use
it. I'm under the impression that it really doesn't matter. This is a hot take, I imagine, but it really doesn't matter what the influence behind the decision is. Like, in the same way that the United States, for all its faults during World War II, was the arsenal of democracy, no matter why it was chosen that way, or what decisions were made on a selfish or altruistic level among the higher powers of administration in the United States, that was the ultimate outcome. And I think in this case, China will be seen for, if there is a history of the 21st century, China will be seen as the arsenal of survival. And that's regardless of whether that's for selfish or altruistic reasons, that is going to be a fact.
Well, in other words, intent may not necessarily matter as long as people are getting their aid that they need right now.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I tend to lean more on the I tend to lean more on the altruistic side, or the side that China is genuine in its motivations and wants to and doesn't want people to die, even if their government is throwing all kinds of accusations their way. I think there's a very general understanding among the people and the government here that regular people aren't responsible for that kind of narrative pushing, and that there's no reason to punish them by denying the aid they need to live. So for me, I do fall more on the, you know, the motives are genuine side, but I also agree that it doesn't really matter.
I guess I wanted to get your thoughts on there's continued talk of Chinese wet markets and people saying, they're reopening these wet markets and that's the cause of this. I just wanted to get your thoughts real briefly on that issue and this talk of there's no regulations and whatnot.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't seen any actual proof of that. The most people have said has been an article from the Daily Mail that uses pictures from Indonesia and Vietnam circa 2015, and old pictures of China as well. There's no actual evidence. There's an unnamed source claiming that they're open again. So I don't even know if those claims hold water in even the most basic sense. But in terms of actual policy, the wildlife trade has been banned. Wildlife consumption has been banned. There's the agricultural department has put out a list of acceptable animals to trade and consume, and most of them are the traditional farm raised. And there are some exceptions for animals that are considered more safe. I mean, I think like turkey is technically considered is considered wildlife, even though it's pretty widely assumed that it's safe. No, I mean the actual policy has been to crack down on these practices. And in terms of, I mean, you say wet, when people say wet market, what they actually mean is an open air market, right? Which means that practically every country has open air markets, you know, farmers markets in the U.S. and elsewhere. There's just a certain connotation with the term wet market now that is, I think, a little pretty racially charged. But as far as the actual wildlife consumption and trade, I have yet to see any documented instances of those places being reopened or anything. That's a concern, and I'm sure it will happen in some places, but it remains to be seen whether that's going to be a widespread phenomenon, whether those places are going to actually stay open if there is a response, because, you know, Chinese people are there's as many outraged Chinese people at some of these practices, because it's not common, you know. This claim that it was, you know, people were eating bat soup or whatever, even though bat soup is native to parts of Micronesia and not China, is its own kind of racist accusation. But it's also not something that most Chinese partake in. You know, pork is the animal. Pork, chicken, beef, lamb, those are what you're going to see more than anything else. And if there is a niche for that kind of consumption, it will be snuffed out over the course of time. So I again caution people to remember the fact that this is a country of 1.5 billion people. It's a big place. It's a diverse place. And assuming that one of these places is back open, and again, that's a big assumption to make, we have to remember that doesn't necessarily mean that's the norm across the rest of the country. It's another instance where one incident is used to kind of paint a nationwide brush.
The only thing I would add to that is it is true, I think, that the term wet markets has become very racially charged. If we're concerned about those type of markets, then I think we should be concerned about factory farming. I think we should be concerned mm-hmm. about deforestation, about land clearing. And I don't think that's just some China problem. But no one seems to want to look at the bigger picture these days for some reason.
Yeah. I mean, as with so many other things, there's just this deliberate focus on one country, but then on one very specific part of the country where they claim that this one thing happening means that it's happening everywhere. You know, it's very myopic and it's very calculated and deliberate, and it's not something we should be giving any credence to.
In closing, I always try to end on a positive note. That's become very, very difficult in the age of novel coronavirus, COVID-19. Anything you can say regarding where things are headed, if there's any, you know, light at the end of the tunnel, globally or otherwise?
Well, I mean, I think we touched on a little bit how this was kind of a moment of great potential in terms of moving on to something totally different, something new, something better. And I think that potential is still there, but it's not going to come from, it's not going to come from media. It's not going to come from the government. It's not going to come from multinational corporations. And it's in some cases not going to come from the kind of left media complex that already exists, right? It's going to come from regular people figuring this stuff out and helping each other out and building networks of support and trust and solidarity among each other. Because the institutions that ostensibly are meant to provide that for them are failing. I think right now we've got to come together, not literally, but you know, within 6 feet or a meter of distance, and try to build something better and build our way out and of this crisis and rely on each other. And it's going to be very difficult. It's going to be very painful. And it's not a good situation to be in, but it's what we're in right now. And I do think that there is potential, but it's going to be fought tooth and nail, and it's going to be fought by throwing blame around. It's going to be fought by demonizing people. The ruling class, the capitalist class, is going to be using every tool in its arsenal to keep people from holding those actually responsible to account. And so right now we just got to survive, and I think it's going to be really hard, but I also think that people can unite and do their best to try to get through it, and that's what it's going to take.
Well, Ian Goodrum, I want to thank you for coming on Parallax Views.
Hey, thanks for having me, guys.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed our conversation with Ian Goodrum of China Daily. I will likely be having other guests on the show in the future to have discussions from other perspectives on the question of China and its relationship to coronavirus. Let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at @viewsparallax or email at parallaxviewspod@protonmail.com. As always, if you can, please consider supporting me on Patreon, where you can hear the Parallax Views current events program, The Week That Was, as well as archived editions of the Parallax Views show. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views to Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing this like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety, problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.